Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us. I remind you on our way to our conversations today that support for this radio station, WEAA, is provided by AAA Mid-Atlantic. More information at AAA.com/discounts. We're going to begin before we begin our program. It's our day in history. It's a little lighter than yesterday, a little lighter than what's going to be tomorrow. Though we'll tell you that Kole Tengele will be joining us tomorrow to read Frederick Douglass' speech and talk about that, the famous speech he gave on July the 4th. I'm talking a great deal about that tomorrow and more. This was a day, really, that some interesting little things happened before we jump into our conversation. In 1953, a huge controversy exploded. Makes me think of the Cheerio commercial explosion we just had. But Harry Belafonte was shown with the actress Janet Leigh on a cover of Ebony magazine. It was the first time that two whites and somebody African-American were seen together on a U.S. magazine cover. It didn't cause a lot of controversy in the black community, but the white community was outraged. Letters were written everywhere wanting to know how this could happen and how he could be standing next to a white woman. That was one of the little pieces that happened today in history. And one of the more important facts in America was that, in 1775, the Prince Hall Masons were founded. And it was called the Africa Lodge No. 1. This is the Black Lodge of Freemasons. It began their own organizations that many folks did because white folks would not allow them in. Slavery was still flourishing. That occurred in 1775. And way ahead of the United States, the Danes freed all the slaves in the Virgin Islands in 1848. Now let's jump into our conversation. We have, it's Johnny Hartman's birthday, by the way. And we will be celebrating that by playing a lot of Johnny Hartman during our breaks during this program. We're now going to talk about a book that I think is probably one of the most important books, most well-researched books I've read in a long time. It's called Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. The authors have both been on this program before. John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and Robert McChesney, author of The Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And he's also professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And welcome, both of us. It's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So is this John or is that Robert?
This is Bob. I think John is on his way to the phone, as I understand it, but this is Bob for now.
Okay, Bob, how are you?
It's great, Mark.
Good. Thanks for being here. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here so that you can join us. Let's begin. As I think my producer just sent me a text, he's trying to reach John. I think John was here a minute ago, but I'm sure he'll get there. To begin with this book, a lot of people have talked about this idea of money and politics, but what you all have done over the last few years is really kind of dive really deeply into the history of this, pull out facts we didn't know, talk about things like the $10 billion election, not the $6 billion election. So talk about the sojourn that you and John took to get this book rolling and why.
Well, Mark, John and I started talking about what became this book probably in the late 90s. I've been monitoring the growth of political advertising and the decline of campaign journalism for two decades. I mean, it's been maybe even longer. I mean, I've always sort of been skeptical about the role that TV political advertising is playing in campaigns, very skeptical about the quality of the content, what it actually contributed to our politics, and concerned about the great cost of it. John and I both have been greatly concerned about really the dreadful news media coverage of campaigns and its degeneration in the last generation as well. So we've been kicking this around, and I think once the Citizens United decision in January 2010 came along, which effectively said that corporations and individuals can both give as much money as they want to campaigns without any restriction. And although it said it didn't approve of this, in effect it opened the door to what has become now largely anonymous and unaccountable contributions of any size, as we document in the book, that this meant the bottom had come completely out of the cup and that we were entering a new era. And I think that's what said we better write a book about this now. This demands immediate attention.
So let's go into some of it. One of the things I think people don't realize that in America, one of the facts you throw out in the very beginning of the book, is that there is there's no constitutional right to a vote in America, And that really, in some ways, after reading that and reading your beginning chapters and putting it all together, that has been the battle over the last, since the beginning of the country, since the writing of the Constitution. It's been a battle over the vote, and there is no constitutional guarantee that we have that right as individual citizens.
You're absolutely right, and I think you put the historical context exactly the way we do in the book, and what we want people to understand this, that from the very beginning of the United States, there has been an ongoing, constant battle over who can vote and how they can vote. At the very beginning of the country, and I think a lot of Americans aren't aware of this, only a fraction of the adult population could actually vote. We've got some of the numbers in the book. I don't know, can't recall them exactly.
You said that 75% of people voted in the late 19th century. That we have now a high in the last 60 years of 58% in 2008 because of Barack Obama, but it's really hovered around 50.
But if you even go back to the beginning of the country, say 1800.
Oh, right, those stats, right. Right.
Then you go back there, and it's the exact opposite. Then we're down to a situation where oftentimes we're talking about maybe 5 or 10% of the adult population actually participating in an election, single digits many times, because African Americans couldn't vote. Men without property couldn't vote in many states until the 1820s or 1830s. Women couldn't vote. Immigrants couldn't vote, even if they were gainfully employed and here for good. All these sorts of factors. So it was a very small voting population. And the great democratic struggles, not just in the United States, but worldwide, have always been expanding the franchise, letting women vote, giving African Americans the right to vote, men without property the right to vote. And these are the milestones of democracy when you expand the franchise. And right through till today, we've seen the battle through the Voting Rights Act of 1965, one of the great laws in American history that really did more for democracy than almost anything else we can think of in recent years, to the very moment right now, the great struggles that are going on with the issue of voter suppression. And I think we put it in context in the sense that this isn't just some sort of arbitrary debate, but rather what's at the center of this is a traditional struggle between the great mass of people in this country for democratic power and those who really have inordinate amounts of property who don't like the idea of politically power being in the hands of those who aren't sympathetic to their role in the world.
So in some ways, before we get into some of the specifics of what you all pulled out in the book, I mean, this has been, as you've just been saying, these battle lines were drawn from the very beginning of the birth of this nation. It might be property rights to limit votes legally back in the 18th century and even through Andrew Jackson and for white men, that is. But that battle has not transformed. The name has been changed. Now we're battling the right of corporations as people as opposed of men with property. But it really is the same battle. It's the same lineage over whose democracy is it.
And, you know, what we point out in the book is that if you go back just 105 years to the Progressive Era, the first 10 or 15 years of the 20th century, what we see is the language is very similar to what it is today. They were making this exact same fight across the country between 1900 and 1915 or 1920 to limit corporate power in politics. In fact, they passed laws in Congress. They passed resolutions, a referenda in Montana to take corporations entirely out of politics. They understood that it was completely corrupting of the process and undermining the ability to have a credible or effective government and avoid total corruption. So this is the same struggle we're having today in many respects took place 100 years ago. So it is not a new thing. But what's changed radically? I mean, a lot of things have changed radically, but one of the most important things that's changed radically is the amount of money to run an effective campaign today. Even factoring in inflation, even factoring in population growth, is still, you know, exponentially greater than it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago, primarily due to the cost of TV advertisements, which is now the lingua franca of campaigns. It's where the vast majority of the money goes. And if you don't have a war chest that can buy your fleet of these ads to bombard people, you can't be a credible candidate in America today.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888, because this is, given what we'll be talking about as well as we did yesterday, what happened with the Voting Rights Act, this is just another piece of the battle against the rights of Americans to really control our own democracy, our own place to live, and always on the backs of communities of color, and it's happening once again. 410-319-8888, we're talking about the book Dollarocracy, how the money and media election complex is destroying America. We're here with Bob McChesney, one of the authors of the book. John Nichols is the other author. He'll be with us in a moment. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or jump onto our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Yeah, I mean, and it's always been, you know, I was looking at these two quotes you had in the beginning of the book, then I'll jump into something else. But you have the King quote that says, "So long as I do not firmly and irrevocably possess the right to vote, I do not possess myself. I cannot make up my mind. It is made up for me. I cannot live as a dramatic democratic citizen, observing the laws that I have helped to enact. I can only submit to the edict of others." And then, as Ben Franklin said, "They who have no voice nor vote in the electing of representatives do not enjoy liberty, but are absolutely enslaved to those who have votes." And, you know, then you talk a bit about, even in the elections we're having today, because of the way the way that we have the power of who manages, runs, and pays for elections, you point out that the numbers of congressional votes in both places like Pennsylvania and around the country, and we've looked at other states here on the show in the last few days, the Democrats, where they've won a majority of the votes for Congress, have a minority of the seats. And that's all about the power of gerrymandering and the power of who gets to elect who to make those decisions for us.
Yeah, absolutely, Mark. And in fact, I mean, I think that the other issue here that relates to all this is voter turnout. And the United States has traditionally the lowest, and especially in recent years, the lowest voter turnout among any advanced democracy in the world, or almost any democracy for that matter. We are, you know, we, on a good year, 52-55% of good presidential year of our eligible, or not of our adults, turn out to vote at the polls. In off-year elections, our congressional elections, it usually plummets to under 40%, sometimes in the mid to low 30s. And then on those other years, those odd number years that we sometimes have elections or the spring elections, sometimes the voter turnout rate in some states can get down under 15% or 20%, which means, you know, less than 10% of the population can elect the leadership. We have this very low voter turnout, and we traditionally encourage low voter turnout, you know, MTV campaigns notwithstanding. We have not done the measures, except in rare cases, to really promote a much higher voter turnout. And this has worked to the advantage, as a rule, of conservative, small c conservative forces, because the evidence shows that people in the wealthiest 15% of the population voted twice the rate of people in the poorest 15% of the population. And there's almost a direct line in voting rates by income, which means it skews our elections very disproportionately towards the interests of those at the top of the income spectrum. Poor people, as a rule, just don't vote that often in the U.S. And they especially don't vote in non-presidential years. That's when poor people, young people, they might get off their butts and go vote on a presidential year, but in those off-year congressional years, those other elections, they're less likely to vote. And what happened in 2010 is that that was a year in which the Republicans won landslide victories across the country. That year, it wasn't a matter that suddenly people who voted Democrat in 2006 and 2008 changed their mind, started voting Republican. Instead, it was just that Democrats didn't go to the polls. Republicans did, so they won landslides. And the reason that's important, and to answer your question about gerrymandering, it's those years that end in the number zero that determine state governments, and then those state governments determine the congressional districts for the next decade. And since 2010 was a non-presidential year and a Republican sweep, the Republicans across the country were able to pretty much ram through their gerrymandered districts, which means that Republicans don't have to win anywhere near a majority of the vote to have complete control over the House of Representatives. This last year, in 2012, more Americans voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives than they did for Republicans. You know, there were more Democratic votes. Yet the Republicans have a landslide majority in the House of Representatives. They control it completely. I think it's a 30-seat majority. That's pure gerrymandering. That's what the effects of gerrymandering is. I think most Americans know that's an affront to any notion of democracy, of one person, one vote. It's one of the things we've got to take care of. We've got to eliminate the ability of any party to doctor the seats in such a way that the will of the people is undermined.
410-319-8888. What is going to happen in the future of this democracy? One of the things and I don't want to give the Democrats a pass here either. You have a great quote in here from Bob Herbert about the Democrats being as tied into money as Republicans. And I think because it goes on both sides. I mean, let me just show you. I'll just read the quote for our listeners very quickly because it's pretty telling. This Bob Herbert wrote, the New York Times Times columnist, wrote that the Republican Party is accurately defined as a party that looks out for the interests of the very wealthy. The Democratic Party less so, but I think they look out for the interests of the wealthy too before they look out for the interests of the working Americans. Because this money, I mean, one of the things that was played up in 2012 and that you wrote about was that this shows how the Democrats won without the need of big money. It was Republicans who had big money, but that was far from the truth. That was not the reality.
Not at all. The Obama campaign ran an extraordinary campaign. They raised a pile of money, just about the same in all put together as the Republicans. And clearly, as we demonstrate in the book, they spent it better, both on TV ads and usually when they get to the internet. But they were full participants in the money-raising complex. Barack Obama spent countless days doing fundraisers in New York and other places with hedge fund managers and other billionaires. You know, if you're going to raise money, you do like Willie Sutton said. That's why I rob banks. That's where the money is. Well, if you're going to raise money, you don't go to a homeless shelter and stick out a tin cup. You go to the Upper West Side of Manhattan or Upper East Side and meet with people whose annual income is in 10 or 11 figures and get your checks there. And he was part of it. And, you know, the way we characterize the Democrats, because this is not a partisan rant against the Republican Party, despite what we just said about gerrymandering. It's a principled critique we're making, and we'd make the same case against gerrymandering when Democrats would do it as well. The whole
absolutely
was wrong.
Yes.
But in the case of the Democrats, I think what's different from them and the Republicans is the Democratic voting base, the people who vote Democratic, especially the people who are the marginal Democratic voters who come out in presidential years, I think it's pretty clear they're far more progressive, far more concerned about Social Security, public education, building infrastructure, fair taxes, than the party itself. I think the higher you go up in the commanding heights of the Democratic Party, the more you find the leadership is completely part of the system, and they operate within the system. They're going to leave Congress if they're members of Congress, like Chris Dodd did, and become $1 million-a-year lobbyists. They are anything but a dissident party. They're very close to the Republicans. The closer you get to the top, on the crucial policies that deal with the economy, that deal with foreign policy, there the differences are much smaller than they are if you go further down to the voting base of the Democratic Party, which tends to be much more, for lack of a better term, to the left of its leadership.
So yeah, it's hard to kind of parcel what those mean in today's world. But I want to jump into here before we go to break to start the conversation about what happened here. I mean, you write about how in the 60s we saw this kind of flush of laws, from laws governing our cars to OSHA to the environmental EPA being started. There was this explosion in America that started in the civil rights movement that enfranchised African Americans for the first time in American history, really, and the kind of unleashing of a movement to change America that swept this country and its consciousness. And then that was very frightening to some people in this country, and there are a lot of things that we didn't know about that were going on to kind of take back the country they thought they were losing, they being those of they being those who are the captains of industry.
That's right. It was really, you really described the situation well. In the 1960s, we had an upsurge of popular politics that created all sorts of opportunities that hadn't existed before. Medicare was the Voting Rights Act. Public broadcasting, for example, was a result of this, too. And we write about that in the book.
Right.
Then the whole Nader movement, which really had business on its heels. And I think now the historians look back at the period from like 1968 to 71 or 2, and business, corporate America, was at its probably low ebb in terms of popularity, in terms of political influence. It was very much on the defensive. And it was deeply concerned about its future because it didn't seem like a lot of Americans thought it had much of a role to play in a healthy country. And this is the context, really, for Dollarocracy, because it's in this dark moment that the Chamber of Commerce of the United States and a handful of business leaders and people very sympathetic to large corporations get together to strategize. What can we do about this? Is there a reverse course and get back to the traditional role of business running everything in America and elections not really having much influence on how this government actually operates? And we talk about in the book a crucial memo that was written by Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell shortly before he joined the U.S. Supreme Court for the Chamber of Commerce. And it's a brilliant, prescient memo because it was a confidential memo to the giants of industry of America, the largest corporations, basically saying, American corporations, you're getting hosed. You're losing. Ralph Nader, who in his view is public enemy number one, the consumer advocates, all these groups are democratizing society in a way that's not favorable to us. We need to have corporations and business take over the government again and run it for our own interest. That's crucial. And we've got to increase our lobbying. We've got to get the media to be more sympathetic to us. We've got to get higher education to be more sympathetic to us. And we've got to take over the courts. All these institutions that were seen as not being sufficiently pro-big business had to be reined in. And they said, we've got to devote our resources to this. And if you look at what happened in American history after that memo was written and distributed privately in 1971, you see by the end of the 1970s, a tenfold increase in corporate lobbying in Washington, D.C. Virtually every trade association, many of which have been based in New York or other cities, moved their headquarters to Washington. And the trade associations for industries no longer were people who were experts in ball bearings or rubber or whatever the industry did, but rather were simply great lobbyists, usually former politicians. And this whole movement began at that time. And it has been a success. And crucial to that movement has been to increase the amount of money in elections, knowing that if you can make money unlimited, and this is one of Powell's pet campaigns when he was a Supreme Court justice, you can make funding for campaigns unlimited, the guys with money are going to win most of the elections, and that would suit business well. And also crucial to the campaign is the idea that limiting the ability of people unsympathetic to you to vote is probably not a bad thing, too, especially if it looks like you'd lose elections otherwise.
And the other co-author of this book, John Nichols, now joins us as well, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive in these times, associate editor of The Capital Times, a daily newspaper of Madison, Wisconsin. John, good to have you with us as well.
It's a pleasure.
410-319-8888 is the number here. We have to take a break here in about 2 minutes, but one of the things we were talking about a moment ago, John, is that, and I think that to me this is some critical parts of the book have to do with the Burger Court, and also under Rehnquist, and also and who he was, how that affected this, but and the Powell memo that Bob McChesney was just talking about. When you read that memo, especially as you have it in the book here, it's mind-boggling because you see there that even though they're saying we haven't lost, they're basically saying to big industry, we can lose our America. They're going to take it away from us. We have to fight back. It's the Civil Liberties Union. It's civil rights groups. It's the ACLU. They're going to, and we have to organize to fight. These what you're exposing really are the roots of what we're facing today.
I think so, and I think it's best put in the context of a specific incident. Lewis Powell was a lawyer who often represented and worked with tobacco industry folks. He, on a particular night, December 31st, I think, 1969, they stopped running tobacco industry, and this was because of congressional action. And it, like a light bulb went off for Powell. He realized that as you expanded voting rights and as more and more citizens were voting and participating in the process, energized by the civil rights and anti-war movements and a lot of women's movements, so many other things, that they were going to start making demands on the system, that the system itself might produce public health results, that it might encourage public safety, that you might make safer cars, that you might make workplaces fairer. And for Powell, this was a realization that the old order could potentially end. And that really underpins his entire memo. And what's important about this is to understand that this fight that we're in right now is part of a 225-year-old fight.
Right.
We have always had a struggle in this country between the money power and the power of the great mass of citizens to shape the society that they want. What Powell said in 1971, in that early period when he wrote that memo, and then when he went on the court, was that it was possible for the old order, for the money power, to reassert itself. Many people didn't believe it at the time. Even Nixon was getting, in the view of many conservatives, soft on these issues. But Powell turned out to be right. He was right about something that Saul Alinsky used to talk about. Saul Alinsky said the only thing that beat organized money was organized people. Well, Powell reversed that calculus and said that organized right. money could beat organized people.
So we have to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back to our two guests in their book, Dollarocracy, John Nichols and Bob McChesney. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The very thought of you makes my heart sing like an April breeze on the wings of spring, and you appear in all that delights me, that thrills and excites me. No. It's just the nearness of you.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. That's the incomparable voice of Johnny Hartman, who was born on this day on July 3rd, 1923, one of our great jazz artists. Listen to that all day, but we have important stuff to talk about, and we're going to do that, continue that conversation with John Nichols and Robert McChesney about their book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And let's jump into... I'm gonna move around here the next 25 minutes or so as we're while we're on the air. But I want to jump into for our listeners, 2012. One of the most intriguing things you talk about, among many intriguing things in this book, is you use the number $10 billion to talk about what happened in that election, and the way you put these numbers together was really fascinating, because we see the number $6 billion in most of the establishment press. But then you start adding up numbers that are not counted up both in the national election and are not counted up in terms of what happens locally in that election and the effect it had as a $10 billion election, John Nichols. That was a pretty eye-opening chapter even for me, and I watched this stuff very carefully.
I know you do, Mark, and we like to open your eyes. That's the whole point of doing a book.
Right.
That was something that we knew we had to do with this book. Because, you know, this is not merely a book about campaign finance. This is also a book about media. And it's a book about how our media has changed. And one of the biggest changes in media is that it has become very Washington-centric. And it's not just media. It's also a lot of the watchdog groups. Folks tend to focus on Washington, D.C. and the national politics, the presidential race. And so when you started to get the figures for 2012, they were overwhelmingly about what was being spent on the presidential race and on races for the House and the Senate. Now, that's totally legitimate, and it's important to look at. And what we found, and there are wonderful folks at Open Secrets and other groups that clearly detailed how more than $6 billion, a record amount of money, was spent on the presidential race and on the congressional races. But a lot of the news reports immediately after those numbers came out said, oh, well, you know, campaign spending didn't go up all that much. It's up some. It's proportionally up. But you know, that's sort of a natural inflation, which, of course, as we show in the book, is not the case. It's explosively growing at the federal level. But the problem was they weren't looking at all of the campaign spending because there's very little integration of the numbers. So what we did in original research was to go out and look state by state, often going into their state political operations, looking at their watchdog groups in different states, looking at what sometimes some states like California do a very good job of monitoring spending. We put this all together. We looked at what some really wonderful smaller-scale watchdog groups are doing across the country, pulled it all together, and then we worked with the Center for Media and Democracy, the group that did Alec Exposed as well as the Fix the Debt campaign, and looked at their research on dark money. When we put it all together, what we found is that in addition to the $6 billion spent on the federal, another $4 billion, almost as much, another $4 billion, perhaps more, was spent on state and local races. And as you say, Mark, it's eye-opening. You had literally hundreds of millions of dollars poured into gubernatorial races because governors, as we're seeing in all these states with Rick Perry in Texas, what's happening in North Carolina, governors and legislatures have immense power. We saw hundreds of billions spent into referendum campaigns. Maryland had some incredibly high spending on gambling issues.
Right.
And we talk about that in the book. But where we really focus on a lot of attention is the incredibly troubling flow of money into local elections. We found city council races that for small districts that were costing $500,000. We found county board races where, you know, literally millions of dollars were flowing into these contests. And you ask yourself, well, why is that happening? Because the same money power that spends a fortune to try and elect presidents and members of Congress has also come to recognize that in this era of unlimited spending and very, very little local media coverage of races, it is possible to literally buy control of local government, which has the ability to regulate, to zone, to make police decisions. And so what we identified with the book is perhaps the biggest crisis of all in our politics, which is at the level of government that most clearly affects us, proportionally, the highest amount of money in the history of the country is being spent on city council races, county board races, and judge races.
And I think that kind of thing is, to me, is phenomenal. You look at you also talk about judicial races in this book, how they were affected in places like West Virginia, Wisconsin, other states, Michigan. The referendums that kind of took the union power away because of the money that people that we only hear nationally, Adelson and others kind of putting in. And I think that what we're seeing here, the way you talk about it, and you talk about it as dark money, which I find the dark money in our politics, because you can't see it.
If I could just quickly clarify that, dark money is exactly what you say. It's something you can't see. But it's also a term of art in the description of these different streams of money. And this is a big deal to understand. I think most Americans believe that at some point, at the end of the day, maybe, you know, it'll take a week or a month or even a year, there will be reports that explain who spent what money to influence us. You know, what campaigns spent, what political action committees spent, what so-called charitable groups spent. But dark money is a rapidly growing category, which is money that you don't know where it came from, you don't know who gave the money, and also you have very little accounting for how the money is spent. But these dark money expenditures, now in the hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps substantially more, are flowing into races across the country. They show up at the end of the race. They come through all sorts of, you know, twisted and turned routes. But what happens is, let's say, Mark, you were running for the city council in Baltimore, and you're running a solid campaign, and your opponent's doing okay, but you're clearly going to win. And then in the last weekend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent on television, radio, mailings, saying what a horrible guy Mark Steiner is. And you're like, who is saying this? Where is this coming from?
Mm-hmm.
And you really, as hard as you try, because of all sorts of structural barriers that have been erected, you can't figure out who just smeared you.
And so if you take that in combination with what you wrote about that went from the elections of 1948, people posited Dewey could have won had he listened to his advertising people, but taken from the election of 1948, the reluctance of some modern candidates in the 50s to kind of want to jump into these media wars, but things began to change. The nature of our technology, and who and how it was used, who uses it, and how well it was used, and who owns it, has began affecting our elections back in the 50s, especially in the 1960s, and now has reached, Bob McChesney, as you all write, a critical point.
Well, I think the historians look at the 1964 presidential election as sort of a crucial turning point, because that was the year of this Daisy ad, which only ran once on national television, and
right.
It was an ad put together by Doyle Dane Birnbach, one of the really great ad agencies on Madison Avenue for the Johnson campaign. And I'm sure listeners are familiar with it, but for those who might not be, It's the ad where it's just a short, I think, 30-second, maybe 60-second spot where a little 10-year-old girl is picking petals off a flower and counting. And then at the end, you see a nuclear mushroom cloud in the background as the world's blowing up. And LBJ comes over and says, you know, these are the stakes. We've learned to love each other or we all perish together. And the message was clear. Barry Goldwater was too comfortable with the idea of blowing up the world for his anti-communist militarism. And it was an ad that had just really changed, didn't change the campaign. Johnson would have won anyway, but it changed the discussion in the campaign. And it was the Goldwater camp found it impossible to respond effectively. It was such a powerful ad. And then you saw going out in 1968, the Nixon campaign took it to the next level. That was the campaign that was made famous by Joe McGinnis's book, The Selling of the President. And you had a young Roger Ailes there, and they basically ran the entire campaign on marketing principles. It was probably the first pure marketing campaign selling a product where, you know, what they were selling had almost nothing to do with what the policies would be that Nixon would pursue as president or what the issues were. They were just, you know, manipulating people like you would try to sell a can of baked beans to people in the supermarket. And that's when it explodes. And you see the amount of money that's going to these political ads in particular for candidates in real terms, when you factor in inflation, when you factor in the growth of population, increasing, you know, 50, 100-fold in the last 40 years, most of this money going again to commercial television, to these companies. 80% of the money ends up in their coffers in most races. And so that's a huge, that's where the bodies lie. The reason why you don't have that sort of spending in most democracies is they don't have a huge commercial television industry that benefits by all this advertising and that battles to make sure that it continues without any interruption.
Well, John Nichols, there's an interesting juncture here between different ideas in this book that I want to kind of see if we can pull together. When you write about what happened to what happened to journalism in America, how it's changed from 1912 and after those elections and the elections of the 30s, and we say there was a period of real journalism that kind of morphed itself into this this journalism, alleged balanced journalism. How does that all fit into the demise of our newspaper industry and the rise of this new technology and what it's meant for these elections, especially in terms of who controls it? It's a little sidebar here. There was an interesting article in the New York Times yesterday how the Tribune, which is cutting back by the thousands on its reporters across the country, is now decided to buy TV stations, which are the most profitable businesses in America when it comes to the media. So, well, I mean, to me, all this is tied together.
Yeah, you pulled it all together right there because, you know, one of the things that's happening is, and Bob alluded to this in his answer, you know, technologies change. And as technologies change, they influence our politics. And they don't just influence our politics in what our politicians and our political campaigners use to communicate, i.e. advertising, be it on in a newspaper, on radio, on TV, or online. They also influence how campaigns are covered, you know, what attention is given to them. And the story of the last century in America is a transition from a period when campaigns were covered from every angle. There was incredibly intense coverage of even the most local politics down to city council races and town clerk races by newspapers that had a lot of resources, and those resources mainly came from advertising dollars, not from subscriptions. But they had a lot of resources, and they had a sense that it was their job to provide a universal coverage. And here's the twist that was most important, Mark. There was also more than one newspaper.
Right.
So towns across the country sometimes had 7, 8, 9, 10 newspapers. New York, a century ago, New York had 24 newspapers covering things from every different perspective. And so there was a dialectic, if you will. All these different communications came in, and you know, people could get a lot of information. And in a way, it wasn't just that the newspapers checked and balanced the politicians. They checked and balanced one another. If one newspaper constantly got something right, people would turn to another one. What we've ended up now with is a terrible, kind of the worst of all circumstances. We've had monopolization. So most communities, Baltimore is a good example, only has one newspaper.
Right.
You still have a lot of them. Now you're down to one. And that one has lost an immense amount of advertising dollars for a variety of reasons, not just the Internet, although the Internet's certainly a real factor. And as that has happened, the newspaper has gutted out its newsroom. Baltimore famous, you know, actually the stuff of, you know, cable television series on the gutting out of the newsroom.
Exactly.
And the problem is, radio's done much the same thing. Radio did a great job of reporting, but radio's had huge cuts as well. Literally thousands of on-air personalities cut since the 1996 Telecommunications Act. Television remains the one entity that makes a lot of money and that could cover campaigns. But unfortunately, television, especially local television, still a primary source of news, has decided not to cover politics, but to cover weather and sports and, you know, sort of whatever pop exercise gimmick happens to come in at the moment. And one of the things we detail in the book is that there are television stations in major markets where there are intense campaigns going on that have actually shaved time off their newscast to fit more ads in.
Right.
And what this all adds up to is a circumstance where, and we detail it in the book, where there are major races in this country where the only information that the vast majority of people get about the contest comes from the ads. Doesn't come from journalism. It doesn't come from any checking and balancing. It literally comes from the advertising. There was a case in Illinois in a race for the state's number two job, lieutenant governor of Illinois, where a guy bought his way through the primary. He beat all sorts of candidates who were much more qualified. This guy had never held public office. Bought his way through the primary. Only after he was nominated were there incredible revelations about drug problems, violence, you know, just a litany of troubles. The guy was such a mess, he was forced to quit the ticket, created a huge crisis in Illinois politics. And the interesting thing is, newspaper after newspaper in Illinois had columnists who would step forward and say, wow, I guess we should have covered that.
So in the last couple minutes we have left before we turn to Texas and what's been going on in Austin with activists there in the state legislature, I wanted to kind of wrap up with you all and talk about where you think this has brought us very quickly from Citizens United to a piece you write about that nobody really knows about very much, which was Knox versus SEIU Local 1000, a really interesting revelation about the Supreme Court taking away the limited powers unions have to fight corporations with their money. Where this all takes us now, I mean, you have some ideas about how we can change America, where we can fight for it back. But those ways you can fight, because you can't fight back unless there are organizations and people who are there to do the fighting.
I think,
yeah, John, go ahead and field that one, because that's right
I'll
up your alley.
Get on, and Bob will have wiser things to add. The one thing we need to understand is that American history is the same struggle from 1776, which we will celebrate tomorrow, to today. And it is always a struggle between organized money, organized power, and the great mass of people. And the interesting thing is that we argue in the book that when you get to a crisis as bad as our current crisis is, that's actually kind of a good thing, because history tells us that in America there comes a boiling point. There comes a point where the great mass of people say, this just is not working anymore. And polling shows this devastating disregard for Congress, this overwhelming distrust of our elected officials, but more than that, a real uncertainty about whether this system can be relied on anymore. That's a point at which, historically, the American people and progressive groupings have organized to try and overturn and change. And the thing we do say in the book is that the United States needs to reintroduce itself to the idea of constitutional amendments initiated and enacted for the purpose of making democracy work. We need a constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United ruling to get big money out of politics.
Amen.
We need a constitutional amendment to get rid, finally, of the Electoral College, something even Richard Nixon said warped our democracy. We need a constitutional amendment to address things like gerrymandering of our districts so that most elections don't matter. And people say, well, that's a lot of constitutional amendments, Mr. Nichols and Mr. McChesney. But the fact of the matter is, if you look back historically, in 1910, if you woke up anywhere in America, you looked out across a country where children worked in factories, where women were in on the 10th to 11th floor of a factory that caught on fire, had locked exits, and threw themselves to the ground to die rather than to burn in the fire. Stories that could have come out of modern Bangladesh being told in New York City. And this country had not reformed itself, had not moved forward. And one of the reasons for that was women didn't have a right to vote. We didn't have an elected Senate. We couldn't tax corporations. We couldn't tax the wealthy. That was 1910. 10 years later, women had the right to vote. We had an elected U.S. Senate. We had the ability to tax corporations. And we had ushered in an era of regulation of our industrial settings, of our factories, protecting women, protecting children. We had done all sorts of incredible changes in a 10-year period because we reached a boiling point and a progressive movement rose up and said, that's got to change.
So,
had similar patterns in the 60s. This is possible, and it's really just it's an imagination leap that we need to make, and we need to make it now.
Well, I hope I can get you two back on for extensive discussions, especially about these amendments and how we push that forward, because we do have to take this back, and there's only one way to do it, and that's by organizing and getting to people with what's going on. And this book I can't recommend highly enough, Dollarocracy. It's really well written, how the money and media election complex is destroying America. It's well worth the read. Put it in your community groups, in your union locals, in your neighborhood organizations. Read the book. Think about how you can stand up and fight back. John Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison. Bob McChesney is author of The Digital Disconnect. We'll be talking to him about that in the next couple of weeks, how capitalism is turning the Internet against democracy. He's also professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Gentlemen, thank you so much, and thank you for this book, and we'll continue this conversation.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to have you all here.